Unseen Diversity, Lecture 3, The Discovery of Bacteria, Part 2.
This lecture is about 17th century microscopy and the discovery of bacteria by one person, Anton van Leeuwenhoek, a Dutch microscopist of the 17th century. And he was not the inventor of microscopes, as is sometimes thought. It's not clear who invented the microscope, but he was the first extensive user of microscopes, and I think most people would say the only extensive user of microscopes in his particular time. And for years and years after his death, I think he can still continue to be the major extensive user. There was no one who saw as many different things as well as Anton van Leeuwenhoek until maybe sometime in the 19th century when microscopy changed in ways that I'll describe a little later. So we don't know who invented the microscope. We don't know who invented lenses. We do know that they were being used, lenses were being used in many different ways previous to the 17th century. There are portraits of people wearing eyeglasses, for example, dating from the 16th century, wearing eyeglasses that we would recognize today as eyeglasses. Presumably there was something before that, maybe individual lenses held up to the eye that might enhance vision. The idea of a lens must have been very early and perhaps obvious in a number of different ways. You can look through a water droplet and see that things are magnified a little bit in different ways. So perhaps it was just so obvious that there's not one particular inventor, but it's the users of lenses that are maybe more interesting. So whoever it was that got the first idea of putting lenses together in such a way that things could be magnified, what invented the microscope? But we don't know who that person is. And whoever it was that decided that we would put lenses together in a particular way to see great long distances was inventing a telescope of some sort. And it's not clear exactly how that line of inventions went as well. What we do know is that in Delft, Holland, in the 17th century, lived a man, Anton van Leeuwenhoek, and that is not the correct Dutch pronunciation of his name. I'm doing an American pronunciation of his name. I've heard the correct Dutch pronunciation, and I'm not going to try to reproduce that. So I will say Anton van Leeuwenhoek. And he was a linen draper in Delft in 17th century. And that means that he was dealing in linen cloth. And one of the tools of that particular trade was a lens for the purpose of examining the weave of the cloth and making sure that it was as fine as the weaver had said it was, etc., and looking for any sorts of flaws in the weaving. So this was a man who was accustomed to using lenses in his own trade. How he became a microscopist is not clear, and part of the reason for that is that he spoke Dutch his entire life. He was not an educated person in the sense that certain other people were educated, some people that he later became associated with who, while we don't call them scientists, were becoming the developers of what would be known as science. There was no word science at this particular time, but there was a burgeoning field that was going to become science. He wasn't educated in the way those people were. He had been an apprentice to a linen draper. That was his education, after some other failed apprenticeships, by the way. And so it's not clear how he came to be a microscopist, but it occurred in his middle ages. It's his middle age, we think, only because that's the first record of any sort of microscopy occurring. Did not seem to happen when he was a younger man. And the particular type of microscope that he was using was not the one that we usually envision if we're thinking of a microscope, a tube with a lens at either end, and we put the object under the microscope and peer down the tube at it. Rather, he was using tiny glass beads that were pressed between two pieces of metal so that you could peer in one side of the glass bead and look at a specimen that was close to the glass bead on the other side. You were essentially looking through a tiny glass bead, like a tiny, tiny droplet of water. And at the time, that was the best type of lens that could be used for looking at tiny things. Lens grinding as an art form had not developed to the point where a perfectly ground lens of the conventional type that you think of when you think of a lens would magnify the sorts of things that Anton van Leeuwenhoek was magnifying. At that time, you could make a perfect or nearly perfect lens if you could blow a perfect or nearly perfect glass sphere, tiny glass sphere. And that was the type of microscope that he was using, a little glass bead. Little digression here. I occasionally teach a course on 17th century microscopy, and I have my students make glass bead lens microscopes because, as I said, it's nothing more than a tiny glass bead clamped between two pieces of metal. They can be made to look very fancy, but that's all they are, and you hold them in your hand. And it's relatively easy to blow a tiny glass bead from the right sort of glass and using a nice hot flame of the sort that you can usually find in a laboratory. So the blowing of a tiny glass bead lens, as I said, is relatively easy. Getting one to be perfect can be done with practice. And I keep using the word perfect, but I mean nearly perfect, or getting one that's good enough to look through and actually see microorganisms can be done with some practice. And one of the things that's amazing about what Anton van Leeuwenhoek did is he not only became very, very good at blowing tiny glass bead lenses, but he also made hundreds and hundreds of microscopes, because to his mind, the way to go about this was to have dedicated microscopes for each specimen. So if he was looking at the leg of a flea, he would build a tiny microscope just for that particular specimen and have the leg of the flea permanently mounted on that microscope. For some of his watery specimens, he was obviously not making permanent mounts for those, but nonetheless, he had hundreds of microscopes that he was using, not just one, which contrary to what people usually think of when they're doing microscopy. Bacteria were not the only thing that van Leeuwenhoek looked at under his many microscopes, many of them dedicated for particular specimens. Bacteria will be the focus here, but let me just digress for a moment on some of the other things that he observed so that you can get an idea of just what a passion this was for him. First of all, since microscopy was so new, van Leeuwenhoek had no way of knowing what he could and couldn't see. Therefore, he looked at everything. He wanted to know why foods tasted the way they did. For example, why pepper tasted sharp and biting in the mouth. And he wanted to know whether it had sharp biting edges to it. So he looked at many, many food items looking for evidence of the way they tasted. Of course, finding nothing, because that's not how it works. But he didn't know that, and he looked. He looked at all different parts of his body and other people's. Not only his own red blood cells, so obviously he was taking some blood from himself, but also his own sperm, in the interest of finding out what was going on with that. He looked at all different parts of other animals and plants. He even looked at explosions under the microscope. And remember, he had to look very, very closely through these tiny glass beads, and the specimen on the other side had to be very, very close. So when he set off one small explosion under the microscope in an effort to try to understand how explosions work, he burned his eyebrows. So he was very inventive in his use of the microscope, doing things far beyond what we do today with microscopy. I'll also say that he was tireless in his observations. It can be tiring to look under an ordinary microscope nowadays. People can do it for hours, but sometimes their eyes get tired. I am very impressed when I read some of the accounts of van Leeuwenhoek, knowing that he must have looked hours and hours to see what he did. One example is the case of his own sperm. he apparently looked at sperm morphology for so many hours that he even saw mutant sperm, sperm with two tails, sperm with two heads, and other sorts, which you should be able to find in a sperm sample, but only after hours. The vast majority are going to be normal-looking sperm. So if I were to have a class examine that particular specimen, I probably couldn't get a class to look for as many hours as are needed to see mutant sperm. And that's just one example of the kind of tireless observation that Van Leeuwenhoek would make. Meanwhile, and this is a little digression away from Van Leeuwenhoek, but then I'll bring it back to Van Leeuwenhoek, was Robert Hooke, who is also a 17th century scientist or developer of science that was also using microscopes and who also gets a great deal of credit for being an early and extensive user of microscopes, and in fact is the author of Micrographia and was one of the early members of the first future scientific society, the Royal Society of London, extremely influential polymath who was not just doing microscopy, but was doing all sorts of what was going to be later called as science. At that time, it was called natural philosophy. And he was using a different sort of microscope than Anton van Leeuwenhoek. He was looking at something more like what it would be like to look through a telescope backwards, or what you can do with a pair of binoculars. You could actually turn them around, look through them backwards. It's not terribly satisfying to do that, but you can see that you get a very different sort of image if you look through telescopes or binoculars backwards. And it's a fairly logical thing that you might say, well, why not try this out as a way to look at tiny things? That's the kind of microscope that Robert Hooke was using, this kind that looks more like a modern microscope. But as I said, lens grinding techniques were such that Robert Hooke was not seeing things as tiny as Van Leeuwenhoek, just because that style of microscope with the lens on either end, that's like a telescope turned around, was not able to resolve those kinds of images in the 17th century. So that's why Robert Hooke is famous for seeing things like the eye of a fly or for fleas in enormous and beautiful detail, but nonetheless things that you can see with your naked eye. You can see the eye of a fly with your naked eye. You can see a flea with your naked eye. So what he was doing was getting wonderful, wonderful detail on those things that are still macroscopic. They're not really microscopic. They're things that require a magnifying glass, but not necessarily a microscope. What Van Leeuwenhoek was doing was orders of magnitude tinier. What he was looking at was orders of magnitude tinier. He was the first to see all sorts of little microorganisms that we now know as protozoans or protists, the sort of thing that if you've ever been in an introductory biology class in which microscopy was being done, you may have seen these organisms, little Euglena, little Paramecium, tiny amoeba, all sorts of little crustaceans of the sort that you might be able to see as tiny dots with your naked eye, but which are wonderfully resolved under the microscope. Whole world of microorganisms, he called these the little animals. He was also the first to see all sorts of cells from animals and plants. And he was the first to see red blood cells, and he was the first to see bacteria. And this is a bit tricky for historians of science who, of course, need evidence for the fact that we're saying that he saw bacteria. What's our evidence that he saw something as tiny as bacteria? We have drawings that are, of course, looking like little bits of punctuation, dots and dashes and squiggles, so there's not much there to go by. But we also have his elaborate calculations as to how tiny these little dots and dashes were. I won't go into all the calculations. I'll just tell you about one particular version of calculation that he did. He looked at red blood cells extensively. Red blood cells are about 7 micrometers in diameter. And in fact, are fairly regular in their size and for many years were used as a sort of standard for sizing things under the microscope. Bacteria tend to be about 1 micrometer, so about the 1/7 of the length of a red blood cell. And some of Van Leeuwenhoek's calculations are in respect to the size of a typical red blood cell. So he will talk about things that are bacteria in their shape, granted limited shapes, bacteria-like in their activities, and in the right order of magnitude, that is, about a seventh the size of red blood cells. Now, his work came to the attention of Robert Hooke through the Royal Society of London and became published in the first scientific journal ever, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London. And notice the word science doesn't appear in that title, and it still does not appear in that title. That's an extant journal. You can still get that journal today. Philosophical was the phrase that was being used for what the activities of this journal were about. And the publications in this first scientific journal were as letters. So Van Leeuwenhoek wrote over the years many, many letters to the Philosophical Transactions and had them published as letters describing what he saw through the microscope. Van Leeuwenhoek was Dutch, spoke only Dutch. His letters had to be translated in order to appear in this English journal. And the members of the Royal Society of London were extremely well-educated men, not linen drapers, as was Anton van Leeuwenhoek, not with just an apprenticeship as education. And so he was looked at as sort of an interesting anomaly by them. Sometimes they didn't quite believe what he wrote in his letters. Sometimes they tried to reproduce what he had seen as best they could with their own microscopes, which were apparently not as good as Van Leeuwenhoek's. Sometimes they were successful, sometimes not. And Van Leeuwenhoek's sightings of bacteria are one particular case in point. Robert Hooke tried to see bacteria in the same way that Van Leeuwenhoek had, and was not successful. In fact, was barely successful seeing just ordinary protozoans and protists, which are larger than bacteria. One of the things that may explain this is that in addition to building exquisite tiny microscopes, Van Leeuwenhoek also played around with lighting. And he did it in such a way that he may have invented something called dark field microscopy, although he certainly didn't name it as such. And I will describe it in this way. You know the phenomenon of having a light beam coming in through a window of a dusty room and being able to see with your naked eye individual particles of dust in the light beam, partly because light is being reflected off each one of those tiny particles of dust. Our eyes are very sensitive to light, and each little particle of dust is acting almost as though it were its own tiny light source. I think, or historians of science think, that Van Leeuwenhoek observed this and tried to set up his lighting in such a way that what he was seeing under the microscope would be reflecting the light back in such a way that each tiny object was its own light source-like entity. One of his descriptions is of red blood cells described as looking like sparkling white sand grains against black velvet, which certainly doesn't sound like ordinary red blood cells under a microscope, but it does sound like dark field microscopy of the sort that gets used for resolving really tiny things like that. Now, nobody ever was able to quite reproduce Van Leeuwenhoek's lighting system, and that may have been part of the problem and the reason that the other that Robert Hooke's fellow Royal Society members and Robert Hooke himself were not able to completely reproduce these things. And an interesting thing about Van Leeuwenhoek is because he had been educated as an apprentice, he was very aware of guild secrets, trade secrets, and actually treated his methods in that particular way, which the Royal Society members found very irritating, by the way, because they were interested in telling each other how they were managing to get their particular experiments done. And Van Leeuwenhoek was treating this as though it were some sort of proprietary guild secret that he was developing and using. I wanted to read some quotes from one of the famous letters of Van Leeuwenhoek. Remember, his publications were in the form of letters. This is letter number 39. And it is a description from him of the bacteria between teeth. And this is one of the earliest descriptions known that can be interpreted in this way as being of bacteria. Here's the quotation, and this was translated from the Dutch. "I then most always saw with great wonder that in said matter were many very little animalcules, very prettily a-moving." That, I think, and I think historians of science who have pored through his letters think, is one of perhaps even the first description of bacteria. Now, there's more to the quotation that suggests that he was looking at something tiny enough and of the right shape to say that these were bacteria. And we also note that the scrapings between teeth that have not been recently cleaned are a wonderful place to get some samples of bacteria for the microscope to this day. So taking a toothpick and scraping a bit of plaque from between the teeth produces a very nice little sample, very much of the sort that Van Leeuwenhoek would have seen. Here's something else he says about the scrapings between teeth. And by the way, it was not only his own teeth, but he would go around deliberately to different people, presumably his neighbors in Delft, and get scrapings from their teeth, and has vivid descriptions of what the teeth were like, what the scrapings were like from teeth of people who rarely clean their teeth versus ones who clean their teeth on some kind of regular basis. In those days, it would have been by brushing with cloth or wiping with cloth and using toothpicks. Here's another quote from him. "All the people living in our United Netherlands are not so many as the living animals that I carry in my own mouth." True and good observation. So the total population of the United Netherlands at that time, not as many as the bacteria that Van Leeuwenhoek could scrape from between his teeth. So even though he was just a linen draper, he was becoming well known through his publications in the Royal Society of London, well enough known that he began to be invited to wealthy, well-educated people's homes, and even became sort of a feature guest because he would bring along little microscopes with him and would, as one of the entertainments at the party, scrape from between guests' teeth and would show them things under the microscope. And one of the remarkable things that was noted by a particular essayist that I'll read from in a couple of minutes is that at first people did not see what Van Leeuwenhoek saw. And then when they did, they exclaimed and were delighted and were amazed, perhaps even horrified. It was a transition of perception, is the way this was described. That if you don't know what you're seeing, if you don't have any particular reality in seeing something, it needs to be pointed out to you for the first time. And then suddenly you see it. There it was before you the entire time. One of the most famous party guests to ever be at a party with Van Leeuwenhoek, getting his teeth scraped for microbes, was Peter the Great of Russia, who was traveling supposedly incognito, but with a huge entourage, and he himself was apparently of fairly large stature. He was traveling all the way from Russia to the Netherlands at that time to learn the art of shipbuilding, and he was a very hands-on czar. So not only was he there with all of his shipbuilders, but he himself wanted to learn how to do that and also was learning Dutch. And so he was a guest at one of the parties and got to have demonstrations by Van Leeuwenhoek. Wonderful place to read about and actually read from some of the letters of Van Leeuwenhoek is Clifford Dobell's Anthony Van Leeuwenhoek and His Little Animals. Wonderful book and influential for many generations of microbiologists. Some people have wondered, and I've wondered too, was he as much of a heretic from the point of view of the Catholic Church at the time in 17th century Europe as Galileo was? I mean, after all, Galileo was getting into some serious trouble from pointing out that some of the planets had their own moons around them, and that the Earth might not be at the center of the universe, but rather we might be simply going around one of many stars. And that was considered to be a serious charge that the Catholic Church could not overlook, and consequently Galileo got into enormous trouble over that. How about van Leeuwenhoek's observations, which point to a very different world that is very different from a human-centered world? As he said, there were more bacteria between his teeth, or more living animals, as he said, between his teeth than there were in the entire population of the United Netherlands. Well, I've thought about this a little bit, and so have plenty of historians of science. One of the things that was going on was he was in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands were one of the most progressive, was one of the most progressive parts of Europe at that time. And in fact, some other fairly controversial philosophers found the Netherlands to be a good place to live for parts of their lives. René Descartes spent quite a bit of time in the Netherlands in the 17th century. Baruch Spinoza spent quite a bit of time in the Netherlands in the 17th century. Not necessarily their whole lives, but some of their writing was done there. It was a good place to be if you had some radical points of view on things. The other thing is that perhaps van Leeuwenhoek's observations really were flying under the radar of the Catholic Church at that time. Catholic Church already had a great deal to say about celestial bodies. Catholic Church didn't have much to say at all about whether there were any much tinier worlds on a microscopic level. So I think there could also have been that aspect, too, that it wasn't recognized as being as controversial as Galileo's observations. But I think it was. And here's a Dutch essayist who I think also believes that these were really challenging new viewpoints. The Dutch essayist was a contemporary of van Leeuwenhoek. His name is Constantine Huygens. Again, I'm not doing the correct Dutch pronunciation. The last name is H-U-Y-G-E-N-S. Has written many wonderful essays about van Leeuwenhoek and other developments in science of that time. And here are some quotes from one of the Huygens essays. He described what was seen under van Leeuwenhoek's microscopes as, quote, a new theater of nature, another world. And here's another quote from this essayist. It is impossible to call anything little or large except by comparison. And finally, another quote, the multiplying of bodies is infinite. That is, you can get tinier and tinier and tinier, larger and larger and larger. I think that if the Catholic Church had interpreted those the right way, those would have just been just as controversial as Galileo's observations were. Of course, it helped enormously that the Netherlands was not a place where someone like van Leeuwenhoek would have been persecuted for his beliefs and writings. Nonetheless, I think this was really a discovery of a new non-human-centered world. It was a huge change in our perceptions of nature that was just beginning at that point. Meanwhile, and here's something really amazing, an exact contemporary of van Leeuwenhoek was living in Delft. He was born in 1632, just as was van Leeuwenhoek, and that is the painter Vermeer. And one of the interesting things about Vermeer and van Leeuwenhoek is that they must have known each other. And historians of science and historians of art have tried mightily to connect the two of them together, to say, here's Vermeer and here's van Leeuwenhoek, both born at the exact same time in this little Dutch village of Delft. It was city-like in its proportions, but nonetheless small because we're still in the 1600s. And they must have known each other, especially since van Leeuwenhoek was so well known. And here is the evidence for that. There are two pieces of evidence as far as I read about it. One is that there are a couple of famous paintings or paintings of Vermeer called The Astronomer and The Geographer that are a little anomalous compared to the rest of his work, the rest of his existing work, and there are only about 35 paintings remaining of Vermeer's. One idea is that van Leeuwenhoek was the subject for those two paintings, The Astronomer and The Geographer. Vermeer really didn't do any other portraits of men, and he really didn't do any other portraits that are known anyway of men identified in particular professions. Second tantalizing bit of evidence is that one of the many side jobs that Van Leeuwenhoek had to support himself, presumably, was that he had some municipal positions that included helping people with their estates, helping families with the estates of their deceased. And when Vermeer died, Van Leeuwenhoek was one of the people that helped to catalog Vermeer's estate. And they actually have the list of what was left of Vermeer's estate. He was bankrupt at that time. And Van Leeuwenhoek is certainly connected in that way. So it's very tantalizing. Art historians hypothesize that Vermeer was using something called a camera obscura, which is a set of lenses that produce the kind of effect that Vermeer is famous for in his 35 existing paintings. And that is this amazing depth of field such that things in the foreground and things in the background have this almost sparkly, perfectly in focus quality, almost as though something special had gone on in the way that he set up his scenes. And that special thing, art historians think, may have been this lens system called the camera obscura. I wish there was more time for me to develop why they think so and what exactly the camera obscura is, but that would be too much of a digression for this course. I do suggest, though, that it's a very interesting area to look into, and one that there's quite a bit of information about, and it will make you relook at Vermeer's paintings in a different way. So those are tantalizing connections between these two contemporaries, Vermeer and Van Leeuwenhoek, and it would be lovely if some letter or other document was unearthed at some point that would connect them even more firmly. Finally, for this lecture on very early microscopy, not only were artists and essayists influenced by the wonderful developments of these new worlds being seen under the microscope, but also poets. And although Alexander Pope is not an exact contemporary, he comes later in the 18th century, early 18th century, nonetheless, he is one of many poets who was, I think, strongly influenced by all of the wonderful developments in science. And I want to recommend to you one of his very long, multi-part poems called The Essay on Man. And I want to close this lecture with a four-line quotation from that. See if you can hear him talking about science in this. One of the amazing things about Alexander Pope is you can find just about everything in science being discussed in this Essay on Man. So here's Alexander Pope to close this lecture. "See through this air, this ocean, and this earth, all matter quick and bursting into birth, above how high progressive life may go, around how wide, how deep extend below." That's Alexander Pope, who certainly by that time had looked at things through a microscope, by the way. He was a very well-educated person and was fascinated with both things that could be seen through the telescope and things that could be seen through the microscope. That concludes microscopy of the 17th century, completely dominated by Van Leeuwenhoek. And we are now going to skip all the way to the 19th century. And that may seem peculiar to people who enjoy history of any sort. Why are we skipping the 18th century? Lots of microscopy occurred in the 18th century. Lots of science occurred in the 18th century. It was a fascinating time to be working in the field of science, as it always is. But the real next bunch of innovations occurred in the later part of the 19th century for looking at and understanding bacteria. There was a hiatus of lots of other different aspects of science being developed, but it wasn't till the end of the 19th century that bacteriology or microbiology as a field picked up once again and brand new things were being discovered. And so that's why we're going to fast forward in the next lecture to the last part of the 19th century.
This ends Lecture 3.